So, today is the appearance day of Lord Varaha, isn't it?
Yes.
All day. So, Archita, I think Archita was singing that song. Prabhupada actually said we should sing that song on this day. So, the words are, is Archita here? Vasati Dashana Shikare Dharani Tavalagna Shashini Kalanka Kalevani Magna Keshava Dhrita Sukara Rupa Jaya Jagadisha Hare. So this is a song of Lord Bor. The words are Vasati Dashana Sikare Dharani Tavalagna. Dharani means the earth. As you know, Lord Varaha performed his most famous pastime of lifting the earth up from the plutonic waters or the whatever they're called. So Dharani means earth. Dharani literally means she who sustains everything, who holds everything, because the earth, well, is holding everything that's on the earth. All these resources. There are different names for the earth. Vasundhara means that the earth bears Vasu, all kinds of wealth and resources, and also she's called Dharani. So this verse says, Vasati, that the earth dwelled, or dwells, Vasati Dashana Shikare, on the tip of your, well, it would be tusk. There's a word in Sanskrit, Dashana, which can mean tooth or fang or tusk or whatever, but it's Vasati Dashana Shikare. Shikara, like the shikara of a temple or like your shika. Anything which is shaped like that, the shika probably used to call it the flag. We wear flags on the back of our head. So, also a temple is called a shikara, the peak or the dome of, or the, what do you call it, of a temple. Pinnacle of a temple. And so, it means pinnacle. Lord Shiva is called Chandrasekhar because he has the moon on his little pinnacle of hair. So anyway, Vasati Dashana Shikare Dharani Tavalagna. The earth dwells on the tip of your tusk and attached to you in that way. Shashini, to show how big Lord Varaha was, Shashini Kalanka Kalevani Magna. And like Shashini, like on the moon, Kalanka Kaleva, like a spot on the moon. Like a spot in the phase of the moon. Anyway, so Keshava Dhrita Sukarupa. So we can sing this. I don't know if you do all the words. Maybe you can just repeat the part Keshava Dhrita Sukara. Sukara is a word for hog or boar. And it literally means because it makes the sound su, which, anyway, next time you're hanging around a boar, you can listen to what sound it makes. But so we'll do that last part responsively. Vasati Dashana Shikare Dharani Tavalagna Shashini Kalanka Kalevani Magna Keshavadrita Shukara Rupa Jaya Jagadisha Hare Jaya Jagadisha Hare Jaya Jagadisha Hare Jita Shukara Rupa Jaya Jagadisha Hare Jaya Jagadisha Hare Vasati Dashana Shikare Dharani Tavalagna Shashini Kalam Kakalevani Magna Keshavajita Shukara Rupa Jaya Jagadisha Hare. Jaya Jagadisha Hare. Jaya Jagadisha Hare. Keshavajita Sukararupa. Jaya Jagadisha Hare. Jaya Jagadisha Hare. Keshava Jita Nara Sukara Rupa. Jaya Jagadisha Hare. Jaya Jagadisha Hare. Jaya Jagadisha Hare. Keshava Jita Sukara Rupa. Jaya Jagadisha Hare. Jaya Jagadisha Hare. Jaya Jagadisha Hare. Jayam Vishnupad Paramahansa Parivrajaka Acharya Stotara Satasi Simari Sri Bhakti Vedanta Swamin Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON Founder Acharya Sri Prabhupada Ki Jai. Jayam Vishnupad Paramahansa Parivrajaka Acharya Stotara Satasi Simari Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur Ki Jai. Nandakoti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. Dhamacharya Siddha Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Sekaho Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Siddhaita Gadadhar Sivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Sri Sri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopinatha Shama Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Gaur Dhan Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai. Mayapur Dham Ki Jai. Jagannath Swami Ki Jai. Gangamai Ki Jai. Jamunamai Ki Jai. Tulsi Devi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai. All glories of the assembled devotees. All glories of the assembled devotees. All glories of the assembled devotees. Sri Varaha Deva Ki Jai, Gaur Premanandi Hari Hari Bol. This class is being broadcast through the internet, isn't it? So we want to greet all the devotees who are listening on the internet. Have your credit cards ready. Actually, I also have to say hello to Maya Priya and Amita Char in Charlottesville, Virginia. They have a nice preaching center there. And so they're faithful listeners of these classes. You don't have to have your credit cards ready. So, anyway, today is the appearance day of Lord Varahadev, and we have this verse here, which is not explicitly about Lord Varahadev, but the nice thing about Krishna consciousness is everything is about everything, which gives us tremendous latitude in speaking at these classes. Anyway, so we'll briefly chant this verse and then read the purport, Prabhupada's purport. Yeah? Oh, no, 18 has a purport.
I know, but 17 also has a purport. That's the one that should have been on the board. Could you rather the 17 do that if you wanted to vote? You wanted 17 and 18, or just 17? But you should have 17
should have. Why don't we just discuss that? Because nowadays we should do everything, you know, by consensus. Okay, so why don't we... Perhaps we can... since this verse is on the board... And since it's sort of, you can understand it without 17, so maybe we'll just chant this so everybody can participate and have some fun. Do them both? All right. At the request of Amal Bhakta Prabhu. So you'll get, it's a double header today, the morning Bhagavatam class. Get two for the price of one. So, Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavatam. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So, 17, this, here it goes. Divisprasho hemakirita kotivir niruddha kashto spuradanga da bhujo kam kampayanto charanaik pade pade katya shukan charka matitya tattastu. So, Prabhupada's translation, their bodies became so tall they seemed to kiss the sky with the crest of their gold crowns. It's interesting. So you don't need to listen to Jimi Hendrix to get all this beautiful imagery. So their bodies became so tall that they seemed to kiss the sky with the crests of their gold crowns. They blocked the view of all directions and while walking shook the earth at every step. Their arms were adorned with brilliant bracelets. They stood as if covering the sun with their waists, which were bound with excellent and beautiful girdles. So, pretty tough guys. Prabhupada's purport. In the demoniac way of civilization, people are interested in getting a body constructed in such a way that when they walk on the street, the earth will tremble. I guess this is like super buff here. They walk on the street, the earth will tremble. And when they stand, it will appear that they cover the sun in the vision of the four directions. If a race appears strong in body, their country is materially considered to be among the highly advanced nations of the world. Since this description of the Bhagavatam is of two demonic persons with big bodies, I think there's some... I mean, Prabhupada is sort of hinting here that having a big body that blocks the sun and makes the earth tremble is not the best thing you can get in life. Although I suppose it's great at beach parties. Anyway, so that now we'll chant this verse quickly. Maybe we won't have so many devotees chant because time is running out and they have this notice here. So, Prajapatir Nama Tayor Akarshit Yak Prak Swadehat Yamayor Ajayata Tang Vai Hiranyakashipu Vidu Praja Yang Tang Hiranyaksham Asuta Sagrataha. Prajapatirnama Tayodakarshit Jagprakswadeha Jamayora Jayata Tangvai Hiranya Kashipung Viduk Praja Yang Tang Hiranyaksham Asuta Sagrata Prajapatirnama Tayodakarshit Yak prakswadehat jamayora jayata Tang vai hiranya kashipung viduk praja Yang tang hiranyakshamasuta ja Whoops, hold it, rewind. Yang tang hiranyakshamasuta sagrata. So maybe I'll just read the translation now and frustrate all the people who are patiently waiting to chant the verse. For those who are listening by the internet, this verse is 3:17:18. So Prabhupada's translation, Kashyapa Prajapati, the creator of living entities, gave his twin sons their names. The one born first he named Hiranyaksha. And the one first conceived by Diti, he named Hiranyakashipu. Purport, there is an authoritative Vedic literature called Pinda Siddhi, in which the scientific understanding of pregnancy is very nicely described. It is stated that when the male secretion enters the menstrual flux in the uterus, in two successive drops, the mother develops two embryos in her womb and brings forth twins in reverse order to that in which they were first conceived. Well, that's logical because the first drop goes in, the next drop goes in, Right? And so the one that went in last comes out first, because the one that went in first ends up, you know, back in line there, has to wait to come out. That's very simple. It's a very simple point. The first child conceived in the womb lives behind the second child, so when the birth takes place, the second child appears first and the first child appears second. In this case, it is understood that Hiranyaksha, the second child conceived, was delivered first, whereas Hiranyakashipu, the child behind him having been conceived first, was born second. That's all simple. So, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishnaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedan Samaniti Namine Namaste Sarasvate Deve Gauravani Pracharini Nirvishesh Shunyavari Paschati Deshatarini. So, if you, many of you have heard of Goldfinger. Well, the firstborn son of Diti is Goldeye. E-Y-E, Goldeye. That's what Hiranyaksha means, Goldeye. And Hiranyakashipu, of course, is gold cushion. Not the kind of name you'd give someone nowadays, at least in English. But in Sanskrit, of course, it's a different culture. It sounds different. You wouldn't name someone nowadays gold cushion or gold pillow, but still, that's Hiranyakashipu. So today is Lord Varaha's appearance day, and I thought I would launch into a philosophical topic, which is that this notion of God, that he can appear as a boar, with tusks, and because he had to dig out the earth. I mean, obviously God is omnipotent, so Krishna doesn't have to come as a boar to lift something. He can lift the whole universe just by thinking about it. Just by his will is sufficient. He's called Satya Sankalpa. Sankalpa in Sanskrit is something like the word will. And Satya is truth, so whatever Krishna wills becomes a fact in the real world. So therefore, this is called lila, or pastime. In the sense that a pastime is something you don't need to do, but it's something you like to do, you enjoy doing. We need to drink water sometimes, and sometimes even breathe, or people in general have to work to get money so that they can continue drinking water and eating and breathing and so on. So there are certain things we need to do. These are called duties, things that are due, karya in Sanskrit. Common word for duty in Sanskrit is karya, which literally means that which is to be done, the to be done. And therefore, the Vedas, the Upanishads, specifically point out that Krishna has no karya, natasya karyam karanang chavidyate. There is no obligatory work. There is no doing that must be done for God, literally. Natasya karyam karanang chavidyate. And what's the other line? It is not seen. An equal to him or a superior is not seen. It doesn't just say there is one, isn't one. It actually gives a little empirical statement here. It says God's equal or superior is not seen. That's actually what it says. So lila is something that a person doesn't need to do. You won't die if you don't do it. You just do it because you enjoy doing it. That's lila. So here we have Krishna coming as a boar, sometimes as a fish. This is quite creative. If you think about children, they sometimes may play like this. A child may get down on the ground and, you know, open its mouth wide like a fish and pretend it's swimming on the rug, or pretend the rug is actually water. Or may just jump in the water and actually swim in real water, for that matter. I mean, people swim in real, not only swim on rugs, but people actually swim in real water. So these activities are interesting, first of all, because they stand in such marked contrast to, we could say, biblical notions of God. And by biblical here, I'm referring to three world religions that ultimately derive their authority or their basic theology from the Bible, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So, although we don't want to oversimplify those traditions, but still, I think it's fair to say that for the most part, God is someone to be revered, to be worshipped. God, what it stresses, is the glory of God, the power of God, and that one should fear God. Not merely in the sense of being terrified, but fear in the sense of a certain type of anxiety. Because if you think of what anxiety is a fear. And so the idea of standing humbly before God and in awe of His power, being anxious about not offending God. I mean, to give an example of, I won't go into it here, but in what I would personally consider to be my own studies, the creation of Christianity based on the teachings of Jesus, though certainly not identical with them, you get a statement by Paul, a letter from Paul, where he wants to make the point that that God has made a new covenant with the chosen people, and ultimately whoever God chooses and whoever chooses God becomes a chosen people. So previously there was this old covenant between God and Israel based on following the law which God gave Israel through Moses. But now the rules are changed. It's a new ball game. And there's a new covenant which is based not on following all these laws, but rather simply having faith that Jesus died for your sins, which was Paul's realization about the mission of Jesus. Anyway, so in arguing this point, because he's giving an argument of why you should believe this, and he says that I was, before I joined the Jesus movement, I was a Pharisee. I strictly followed the laws. I believed that I could please God and ultimately get salvation by strictly following all these laws that God had given us. Something like Smarta Brahmanism in India. A lot like it in some ways. And so Paul gives the argument that, which I think is actually ultimately in some ways a false argument. But he gives the argument that, look, no one can follow all the rules perfectly. That's true. And Prabhupada, when he came to America, he told Allen Ginsberg that you wouldn't believe how many rules I didn't bring if you think I brought a lot of rules. So no one can follow all the rules perfectly. Then Paul argues that under this old covenant, and a covenant is like a legal contract. It's between a vassal and a lord. It's a contract. It's the idea that God makes a contract with you that if you do this, I'll do that for you. You do this for me, I'll do that for you. Which in a sense, I mean, there's a covenant you could say in the Bhagavad Gita. At the very end where Krishna says, Sarva dharman parityaja vamekam sharanam braja. Give up all varieties of dharma, surrender to me, and I will free you from all your sins. Don't worry about it. So this is a covenant. A covenant doesn't mean it's like a selfish business where both parties simply seek some material gain, but it means there's an agreement. You do this, I'll do that. And that's exactly how the Gita ends, with a great covenant. So Paul is arguing that the rules of the covenant are changed. God has rewritten the contract because no one followed the old one anyway. And so he's got a new contract. And this contract, you believe in his realizations about Jesus. That's basically the new covenant. Anyway, the point I want to make is Paul argues that the reason the law doesn't work anymore is that no one can follow the law perfectly, true. And if you don't follow the law at any point, God condemns you. God condemns you, and the punishment, once you be condemned, is that another legal term. Covenant is a legal term. Condemnation is another legal term. You know, a court condemns you or finds you guilty. And the punishment, when you are thus condemned by God, is death. But since Jesus already died, you don't have to take this punishment. Just believe that Jesus died instead of you, and then up you go. Anyway, I won't go further in this critique of Paul's realizations about Jesus, which became official doctrines of Christianity. But suffice it to say that this conception of God, that God gives you all these laws and rules, and if you mess up on any one of them, you are condemned to death. And not only condemned to death, but you're going to die for a long time. It's not just bad karma. We're not talking here about bad karma. We're talking about you're a major loser. You may be suffering for longer than you ever wanted to suffer. So the point here is that really the nature of God? Is that really the nature of God that if you do one little thing wrong, he'll condemn you to death? So if you think about what life was like back then in the ancient world, there was no American Civil Liberties Union, which almost makes it that ancient culture attractive. But anyway, there was no American Civil Liberties Union. There were no human rights. There was no First Amendment to the Constitution, et cetera, et cetera. And lords, whether it was the father of the house or whether it was the king, basically people in charge had the power of life and death over the people beneath them. And of course, the ancient wisdom literature exhorts leaders to be just. You know, all the prophets tell the kings, don't be unfair to the people, don't be cruel. But basically, legally, they had that power. And so you really had to tremble in fear before a master, before a lord, because they could do anything with you. So there's this conception of God, King of Kings, Lord of Lords. And therefore, if you break the law, any law, the punishment obviously is death. Anyway, I think there are significant problems with this conception of God. The reason I brought all this up is that, I actually am going to get Lord Varaha here. The reason I brought this up is because the Vaishnava conception of God, especially in its higher formulations and the more advanced understanding, like the understanding of Varaha, is very different. God is not simply a dangerous supreme authority who is merciful, but at the same time easily outraged and can, you know, slow, quick to anger, quick to... It's almost like Lord Shiva, isn't it? Who can be quick to anger and quick to be satisfied. So here you have a God who is not merely King of Kings, but, I mean, take for example in the Damodar prayer, the third stanza of the Damodar prayer, that itidrik swalila bhirananda kunde sugosham nimajantam akhyapayantam tadiyeshita geshu bhaktair jitatvang punak prematastam shatavriti vande, which means that by such pastimes, which have just been described by the verses beginning Namam Ishwaram and Rudantam and so on, by those pastimes of Lord Damodar, Ananda Kunde, in a kunda, like Radha, in a pool of ecstasy, Sagosham, your own people, Nimajantam, you're submerging your own people in this pool of ecstasy, and Akhyapayantam, at the same time you are announcing. Akhyapayantam really means announcing, declaring, making it known, having it announced throughout the world, bhaktayarjita, and announcing it, having it announced, tadiyeshita geshu, among those who know only, the only is implied here, among those who know only your ishita, your lordship, literally. Your position as Lord. Tadiya. Tadiyeshita geshu. Gya. Among those who know you only as Lord, you are announcing, you are having it announced among those people by these pastimes, having it declared that you are conquered by your devotees. Bhaktair jita tvam. So, now, Krishna, first of all, is a youth. This is quite interesting. God, it's not that there is some supreme God who occasionally plays as a young boy. It's really the opposite. It's actually that there is a supreme person who is a young boy who sometimes plays as God. In other words, Krishna in his original form is Krishna. Krishna, God in his original form, Adi Purusha, that means, you know, where the Purusha stops. That means what God is originally, before everything else, the Adi Purusha, he's a young boy. And he's playing, and because there's need, or because some devotees desire it, then he expands himself eternally. He's eternally expanded into forms which provoke awe and reverence and so on. So now that gets to another point I wanted to bring in here, which is a sort of a purely philosophical point, a logical point, and that is the difference between necessity and freedom. In some ways, these are opposed. And I think you have to really grasp philosophically the opposition between necessity and freedom in order to understand Krishna's pastimes, at least philosophically. And that is that, in other words, if you are forced to do something, necessity, then it's not the same as doing it freely, if you're forced to do it. Of course, you could say, for example, that, well, drinking water or something that contains water, like lemonade, is a necessity. But I don't have to drink water. I could just not drink water and die of thirst. That's an option. It's not a very intelligent option, but technically someone, and I'm sure people in the past have done that. So, but then again, we could say that drinking water is a physiological necessity, but it's not a psychological necessity. In other words, it's not an existential necessity. It's not that you, as a living being, necessarily drink water. You could choose not to, and you know, we could all be stupid and just die unnecessarily. But the point is that to say something is a necessity, we have to distinguish between a physical necessity and something that you literally cannot not do. For example, let's say if some, let's say a cyclops comes charging into this area and somehow picks me up and then drops me. I thought I'd say cyclops just to make sure no one's sleeping here. So, if I get dropped by the green, scaly claws of a cyclops, then the point is that I have no choice but to fall. It's not like drinking water. You can drink water or not drink water, even though your body needs it to survive. But if someone picks me up and drops me, there's no choice there. It's actually necessary that I fall. It's actually, and by the way, this is just, I won't get into this, but in the, third canto of the Bhagavatam, or the sixth canto, this is the whole point of that story about Jayant Vijay. But where Prabhupada says the conclusion is no one falls in Vaikuntha, that's actually what the topic is. Can someone be forced to fall? Anyway, if you read it carefully in the Sanskrit, that's what the topic is. But the point here is things which you are forced to do, things which you necessarily do, things for which you have no choice at all, you cannot do freely. Now, let's say, for example, I've just been dropped by the cyclops and I'm falling through space. Now, I still have some freedom. I can choose to love what's happening to me if I've, you know, read enough New Age books. I can choose to love what's happening to me. I can embrace it, or I can choose to pray, or I can close my eyes, or I can whatever. Or I can actually, you know, suddenly I cleverly put a little parachute on my back so I saw the cyclops coming so I can pull the string of my parachute. But anyway, what I mean to say is, once you are falling, you still have some freedom, but at least in regard to falling, the act of falling itself, you're not free to choose. So that which you are forced to do, that which you must do, you do not do freely. And therefore, if we look at God, and we say, if God has to do certain things, then how could God be free? Or, if we were forced to obey God, how could we freely obey God, and how could there be any meaning to the relationship with God? So Krishna, what we find in God, getting back to those Middle Eastern conceptions of God, which then spread to other parts of the world, where God is seen predominantly as this very heavy, dangerous, but merciful, if you treat him right, Lord, this authority. And, I mean, this gets into all kinds of topics that we can't cover here without egregiously violating this. But, I mean, this topic actually was a very hot, burning issue in Europe in European Western intellectual history for some centuries over the issue of predestination. I mean, actually, it starts even earlier. It starts with Augustine, where consider the tension between, you could call it karma mimamsa philosophy, where it said that if you push the right buttons, God has to give you salvation. Right? I mean, that's karma mimamsa, where you don't have to worry about God. It's not personal. It's mechanistic. If you do the right things, you have to get the result. That's karma mimamsa philosophy, or purva mimamsa. Now, opposed to that, you have the notion that God is free. I mean, you have the real understanding that God is actually free. So now you have periods in Christian theology where they thought, well, wait a second. If God is really free, then how could God be bound by any rules such as, if you are a good Christian, you'll go to heaven? Or if you obey God, then God will give you salvation. If that were true, where would be God's freedom? Therefore, they went to the other extreme and I think came up with some pretty lamentable theology. But anyway, they went to the other extreme and started saying, there's no saying who's saved. You start getting all this existential anxiety in Christianity. Well, you can't say who's saved or who's not saved. God has predetermined that some people will be saved. And of course, not everyone believed this. But ultimately, there's no cause. If you take the notion, even the language Prabhupada used, causeless mercy. And if you take it, I think, in the wrong way, you could say, well, if it's really causeless mercy, then it doesn't matter what I do. Because I can't cause God to give me his mercy just by behaving properly. And this became a burning issue. I think a little common sense would have put the fire out in all these philosophical problems they had. The common sense is this. And anyway, with Augustine, then this issue became really a raging issue with the Protestant Reformation, with Luther and Calvin and predestinarianism and all this stuff. So I think that this raging theological fire could have been put out, like I said, with a little common sense. The common sense being what Krishna says in the Gita, where Krishna says that jayajata mam prapadyante, that as they approach me, I reward them. Krishna, by his own free will, God, not bound by any laws above him, but by his own free will, God chooses to establish a system of reciprocity. Krishna freely establishes, freely ordains justice between himself and living beings, so that you do get fair reciprocation from God. This does not mean God is bound by any laws above him. It simply means that he freely agrees not to be an idiot. Anyway, this apparently didn't occur to a lot of people for many centuries in Europe, which makes you suspect their real motive was to fight with each other. But now, getting to Lord Varaha, the point here is that he's having a great time. This is God. God is not simply someone who's stuck in some pretty boring role. I mean, how would you like to just sit on a throne for trillions of years? I mean, how would it even feel? I mean, to sit in a throne and just to do such fascinating things as throwing people into lakes of fire and you know, ruling and judging and so on. I mean, what would you do for a life? So Krishna, God is actually young, God is free, and he does all these far-out things. He comes as Lord Varaha and has a great time and plays. And you know, it's like the ultimate ball game where the ball, you know, you use planets for balls. It's sort of like cosmic lacrosse, you know, where you have this little thing, you pick the ball up. Or I guess for those of you in the Southern Hemisphere, cosmic highlight. Anyway, so this is Krishna just having a great time, coming as Lord Varaha. And so we can go beyond mere reverence. Because reverence does create distance. After all, big people even create physical distance. It's considered bad manners to even physically get too close to an important person. Not only for security reasons, but just for sort of an intuitive sense of propriety. That's why so-called important people put walls around their houses and have land, and they just, you know, they want their privacy. They don't. So proximity or distance have something to do with intimacy. You can't simultaneously be very distant from someone and very intimate with them. I mean, people even talk that way in common language. I feel that we're growing apart. I feel there's a distance between us. And so this mood of extreme reverence and awe creates distance. And it's appropriate to have that reverence when a lack of distance might put you at jeopardy. In other words, you might commit an offense. And that's why Prabhupada said we worship Sri Sri Lakshmi, Radha Krishna as Lakshmi Narayan. We know it's Radha Krishna. I mean, Krishna's got his flute and everything, but there's sort of this mood of formality and reverence to protect us. To protect us from the risk of violating that intimacy through offenses. But still, ultimately, the goal must be intimate love with God, and that requires that this the distance necessarily created by mere reverence ultimately has to be removed. Anyway, so we can appreciate all these things. And there's another topic I was going to go into, but I can't now, and that is the just the nature of mythology and the how the interface between history and mythology, as in stories like this of big giants being born, and how to understand that. But anyway, we'll stop here. Lord Varaha ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Questions? Any questions? Yes, out there in TV land? Yes. Yes. I think the point is they didn't really fall. It's not a real fall. Because if you fall into Krishna's pastimes, you know, we should be so lucky as to fall down into Krishna Leela. So, since there was no fault on their part, it's understood that even when they took these unforgettable bodies, like gold eye and gold cushion, that they were not in the sort of like the despicable, horribly contracted, evil consciousness of a regular monster. I mean, normally, if you do bad things, your consciousness shrinks, and so, you know, your selfish will may expand, but your actual awareness of reality shrinks. And so it's understood they were in a different state of consciousness. And therefore, it really is pastime. Everything about this is extraordinary. Yes? Yes. And I would add to that, I suspect that they kind of got into it. In other words, if you think about it, playing games like that, theatrical, and even sometimes you play the monster. One thing I've noticed is that when devotees put on plays, usually the greatest dramatic energy is spent by the devotees that play the demons. And those always seem to be the most authentic and, enthusiastic acting. So, I mean, we see that devotees really get into it. And so we've seen all over the world that devotees really can enthusiastically get into the demon role. I mean, it seems like sometimes more than the other one. And so I suspect that Jai and Vijay had some type of budding theatrical propensities. Yes. Well, innocent bystanders, after all, even if Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha had never, there had never been such personas, Still, the pastime of creating the material world guarantees that everybody's going to be killed just by time itself. That's what Krishna says. When Arjuna saw Krishna devouring the universe, he said, Kobavan, who are you? Ugra Rupo, in this terrible form. And Krishna said, Kalosmi, time I am. Loka Kshaitra, destroyer of the worlds. So as time, Krishna destroys everything anyway. So it's not that someone was going to live forever on in this world, but they, you know, their perpetual life was aborted by these sort of clumsy pastimes that messed up what people really deserve to get. So we'll stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Señora Ra. Oh, obrigado.